The following programming is sponsored by Clean and Sober Media. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
If you need immediate help, please call the National Substance Abuse and Mental Health Hotline at 1-800-662-HELP. Welcome to Clean and Sober Radio, brought to you in part by Jefferson University Hospitals and Thomas Jefferson University, providing excellent clinical and compassionate care in the Philadelphia region, a proven leader in healthcare and education since 1825. And now, here are your hosts, Gary Hendler and Mark Sigmund.
Hey, hi, everybody, and welcome to the show. Clean and Sober Radio features real people with real stories about addiction to drugs and alcohol. Mark Sigmund, what's new this week in recovery news?
So there's a marijuana is in the news, a new study on the impact of marijuana consumption on people's use of other drugs suggests that for many, cannabis may act as a less dangerous substitute, allowing people to reduce their intake of substances such as alcohol, methamphetamines, and opioids. The survey interviewed 23,500 people in New Zealand. And many of them, again, this was self-reporting, were saying they were cutting down on other things and just smoking pot instead.
I don't know. Listen, I don't think I could have stopped taking Quaaludes or snorting cocaine for marijuana. So maybe it's true. I don't know.
Well, and, you know, I'm thinking they're probably interviewing people that are non-addicts, a lot of them. Right. Maybe they were switching off. Yeah, but for addicts, you usually see it leads back to the drug of choice. Now, there are some cases with trauma and also some cases with pain management, you know, where people do that instead of opioids, which is fantastic to get away from the opioids. But yeah, I don't know. It was from a marijuana magazine, though, this survey. So
right. it's somebody's
view. Yes, somebody's perspective.
Right. Okay, let's do this. Listen, we're going to take our first break. When we come back, Brian Cuban is our guest, and Brian is an expert on a lot of stuff. Drug addiction, drug rehabilitation, alcoholism. He's a lawyer, activist, First Amendment issues, and hate speech. He happens to be the brother of Mark Cuban, but he has, in his own right, an incredible story. We'll be right back.
This is Clean and Sober Radio.
A cancer diagnosis can knock the wind out of you. The Sidney Kimmel Cancer Center at Abington Jefferson Health can help. Our brand new Asplund Cancer Pavilion brings you 86,000 square feet of cancer-fighting science for truly comprehensive care. Backed by the strength of an NCI-designated cancer center. Call 1-800-JEFF now. The Sidney Kimmel Cancer Center at Abington Jefferson Health. The power to out-science cancer.
This is Elvin Bishop, and I listen to Clean and Sober Radio.
888-728-9941. This is Clean and Sober Radio.
You can always enjoy this show on WWDB in Philadelphia, 96.5 FM High Def 2 in Philadelphia, WGAC in Augusta, Georgia, WNBR in Tampa, Florida. They're just a few of the stations.
Going all over the world, Gary.
Over. All right, listen, before we start the show, you know, we're on this drive now. We have to raise money to keep this show going. Please, if you're enjoying this show like you've done in the last 12 years, make a donation. $1, $5, $400. We don't care what it is, right?
Yes. Go to the website, www.cleanandsoberbroadcasting.com, and there's a PayPal button on there. Send us, like, you know, a few $1,000s.
Absolutely.
Don't you think?
That would be fabulous.
Yes.
And if you do that, we'll mention your name on the radio.
We will. Actually, if they send us that much, we'll mention it every show for the next...
No, we'll just keep mentioning your name for an hour.
Yeah, for like a year.
Yeah. All right, listen, you know, besides listening to us, you can watch us, go on Facebook, Clean and Sober Radio. That's our page on Facebook. And please, when you reach out to us, we want to know where you're reaching out to us from. It's fun. We get to know where everybody is. And that's the best way to get your name read on the radio. Okay? All right, enough of that. Okay. Brian Cuban is our guest. He's been here several times. I want to say many, several. A wonderful guy. He really gives back. He works the program, and he's an all-around good guy. Brian, welcome to Clean and Sober Radio.
Hey, Brian.
Hey, here. Hey, guys. Good to talk to you again.
Good. How are you doing? I know that you just had an anniversary, didn't you?
No, I'm April 8th, so I hit, 18 or 17.5 years, yeah.
Yeah, that's good. Listen, Brian, of course, you remember when we couldn't get a day or a weekend?
Yeah, you know, like they say, it's a good start.
It's a good start. So how are you? What's going on with you right now?
Well, like everyone, I'm, winding down from all the drama of the election, and especially with my brother being out there so publicly.
Right.
Man, you wouldn't believe some of that just out emails I got. I'm like, I'm not the one out there. Leave me alone.
Well, listen, you know, people are going to do that. You know, I think I've said this before when we have started the show together. Is it okay to mention your brother? You know, I know you get it all day long, I'm sure, you know.
Yeah. But, I think when you get into politics, people are just so emotional that they can't get to Mark. They search me out and send me these just horrific emails. Just horrific emails. It was like calling me names, calling my wife names. I'm like, holy hell.
Yeah.
You don't know me.
It's so disgusting. Anyway, I'm sure that most of our audience.
So I'm glad to wind down from that. I'm doing a lot of speaking on recovery, and I have my new novel coming out next month.
Well, I have your novel. I have Ambulance Chasers here, which we're showing to our audience right now. But you've had, Body Brokers, Ambulance Chaser, Shattered Image. We'll get into that. The Addicted Lawyer. I mean, I was thinking about this on the way to the studio. Yes, your brother has accomplished a lot of stuff. But you know what, Brian? And not to lessen anything that Mark did, you have saved your own life, and you have saved who knows how many people by being out there and spreading the word that there is hope and there is help out there. And for that, you're the greatest. You know that?
Well, I appreciate that. You know how it is, Gary. You guys do the same with the radio show. You try to touch one person and hope that that one person finds that path to a sustained recovery.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Now, okay, so you grew up in the Pittsburgh area, is that correct?
That's correct, born and raised. And although I've lived in Dallas since 1986, I came here right out of law school. I went to Penn State and Pitt Law. Mm-hmm. So, I'm a Pennsylvania guy.
We can relate to that, right?
Yes, we can.
You know, Brian, I was friendly with your mom. I don't know if you knew this, but Shirley, for years on Facebook, almost every day, we used to talk.
Yeah, no, you mentioned that. Yeah. That's great. She passed in 2018, and she is missed.
Yes, and she was involved in...
I meant 2022, I'm sorry.
22. And she was involved in the recovery movement, not herself, but helping others, wasn't she?
Yeah, she worked for, back in the day, she was a drug counselor, I want to say at Gateway in Pittsburgh.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, so, you know what's funny, Gary? My mom is, back before social media, my mom was she was writing op-eds advocating for legalizing heroin.
Really?
She was kind of ahead of her time.
And I guess you listened to her, right?
Cocaine was my thing, as you know.
But, yeah. So what was it?
I was a youngster.
So tell our audience, what was it like growing up in your house? I know you have two brothers. What was the atmosphere in your house? It was a working, your dad was a working guy, right?
Yeah, my dad was, we were middle class. Mm-hmm. My dad ran what is called a trim shop outside of Pittsburgh. And what they did was they reupholstered car seats
right.
car seats, mm-hmm. and put on convertible tops. That's all they did. And he ran that shop with his older brother, and Marty, until Marty died in 1999. And, you know, Mark, Jeff, I have a younger brother, Jeff. We're all very different. We're all about 2.5 years apart. Mark's the oldest. I'm the middle. Mm-hmm. And Mark, even as a kid, he was outgoing. He was selling this door-to-door, selling that door-to-door.
Right.
And I remember that there was a printer strike, so both our newspapers shut down, the Pittsburgh Press and the Post-Gazette.
Yeah.
And he and his buddies, barely old enough to drive, went out to Cleveland, bought their newspapers, the Cleveland Plain Dealer. And they drove them back to Pittsburgh and sold them on the street corner during morning rush hour.
Oh, my gosh.
That's twice what they paid for.
He was like an entrepreneur way before he should have been, right?
15 years old. 15 years old, yes. So you kind of knew what he was going to be. And my younger brother, Jeff, was a jock, a nationally ranked wrestler.
Yeah.
You know,
he looks like that. Party. Yeah.
He was very into wrestling and, you know, the prom and the dates and the girls, the drinking, the party.
Right.
You know, and as a middle kid, I was very shy. I wasn't like any of that.
Right.
And I was a heavy kid, too. And I was bullied severely at school. And there was a very traumatic incident that kind of started forming the traumatic core of a lot of the behaviors I engaged in.
What happened?
And alcohol.
What happened?
Well, do you remember Saturday Night Fever?
Sure.
So back, I was a freshman in high school, and this was going on the disco era, right? 1976.
Yep.
And Mark was teaching disco in downtown Pittsburgh, believe it or not.
He was teaching what?
Disco.
Disco.
He was teaching disco. He was teaching it in downtown Pittsburgh at this club.
Yeah.
And so he would come home and he would have these bell-bottom pants, platform shoes, right?
Yeah.
You know, that raised them up 5 inches.
Yeah.
And sometimes they had flowers on them and this and that. And one day he came into my bedroom and he's holding a pair of these shiny gold bell-bottom disco pants.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just imagine, you know, John Travolta in these things from the movie.
Yeah.
And he asked me if I wanted them, and I said, sure. And the problem was that they fit Mark okay. I was an obese kid.
They didn't fit
you. I had to jump up and down.
Yeah.
You know, I had to jump up and down, spray the water bottle. My butt looked like 15 cats trying to get out. But I shoehorned, you know.
That's funny stuff.
I got a shoehorn and shoehorned my way into them.
Right.
And I wore them to school, and the kids made fun of me. And I was already being fat shamed severely. Geez. And you have to remember, this is before the internet, right?
Yeah.
In my mind, these kids who were taunting me were the popular kids.
Yeah.
The prom kings, the prom queens, the kids that were going to the football games.
Yep.
The kids who were going to concerts.
Yep.
You know, and I wanted to be included in that, so I kind of became the sad clown and took it and hoped that it might be like a fraternity hazing where one day they'd say, Cubes, that was my nickname, you're one of us now. But that's not how bullying works, right?
Yeah. That's sad.
So I'm walking. Yeah, it was a difficult time in my life. So I'm walking home from school one day with these kids, this group of kids, about a mile walk from the high school to our house in the suburb of Mount Lebanon, outside of Pittsburgh. And we're walking on the sidewalk along a busy street. I'm wearing my shiny gold bell-bottom disco pants.
Oh, my God.
Yep.
Yeah.
My stomach's hanging out. They're making fun of me. And one kid grabs at the zipper, and it rips.
Oh, geez.
Just barely rips at the zipper. Another kid goes, ooh. And he grabs, and it rips it right down the crotch.
Oh, my God.
Okay?
Yeah.
Then the other kid jumped in, and they physically assaulted me.
Oh.
And they ripped the pants off me out of my Fruit of the Loom tighty whities.
Yeah.
And I was wearing a Pittsburgh Pirates t-shirt, 3-ring tube socks, and my kids' tennis shoes. I was a product of my times.
Oh, my.
And then they threw the shreds out in the street. They went on high-fiving down the sidewalk like they had done the funniest thing ever. I had to wait for a lull in traffic. I grabbed the shreds and I covered up my Fruit of the Looms.
Yeah.
And I waddled home. And it might as well have been a walk from Philadelphia to Seattle, right? That walk of shame.
I'm sure.
That's how long that mile walk seemed.
And you never and forget it.
No, you don't.
No, you don't.
And you know what the worst part of that walkway?
What?
Stoplights. Every stoplight seemed to take an hour, and I couldn't get across. And people were staring at me. No one, you know, said anything. And I finally got home, and the house was empty. And I walked down into the basement.
Mm-hmm.
And we had these old blue painted wooden stairs down into our basement.
Mm-hmm.
And the stairs creaked. And I never paid attention to the creaks before,
right,
as often happens in an old house, right?
It
makes noises.
Sure.
But now each little creak felt like a stone thrown onto a pond and the ripples of that creek, right? You know how you see the little ripples from the stone?
Everything was amplified, right, in this horrible situation.
Yes.
Yeah.
And those creaks, in my mind, rippled out to my father reupholstering a car seat. He was going to say, you know, you can't even stand up for yourself. You know, get out. He wouldn't have said that.
Right.
Rippled out to my mom, you know, who would have said the same, my brothers. And I was so ashamed.
Yeah.
So I found the wastebasket. And I put the shreds underneath newspapers and, mm-hmm, you know, open cans and hid them, hoping that would hide my shame, hide my embarrassment. But that's not how trauma works. Trauma threads, trauma remembers. And trauma has a way of making itself known at times you don't expect it to. And it may not even be, you know, you're doing something, you may not even realize what's driving it. Because you compartmentalize shame. You compartmentalize trauma, right?
Yep, yep.
And so it was right around then, this was a freshman in high school, 1976, that I remembered seeing my reflection in the mirror and seeing only a fat pig, as the kids would call me, seeing somebody who would never be loved, never have a girlfriend, and wasn't worthy of any of it. So when we talk about kind of snapshots, and again, I'm not saying that is cause, right? Cause and correlation are two different things. But it's a moment I remember in terms of how I viewed myself and how I viewed my life.
What?
So that would be one of like the major snapshots of my life that kind of changed how I saw myself.
Well, you know, it's so predictable because, listen, we're talking about it now. This was 50 years ago, and you know, we all have encountered trauma, which have led us, because you know how we, just what you said, Brian, low self-esteem, you know, for certain things that happened in our lives, and it's very predictable. And as you're telling this story, I'm picturing your house, I'm picturing you down the stairs, I'm picturing what these bullies did to you. And it's really disturbing.
It is. Brian, I wanted to ask you, you know, you had this experience. You started out by talking about how you were getting these real nasty emails, right? And stuff. Did that trigger some of that old stuff?
Not really, because now, you know, I mean, I'm 63 years old. It just goes with the territory of having a famous brother.
Gotcha.
Right? You know, so I've learned to let that stuff roll off. You know, if I let that stuff bother me now, you know, I'd be going out and doing rails every other night.
Well, I'm assuming you got into therapy and stuff, didn't you?
Well, it was a long time. I mean, I went on to Penn State University carrying this trauma because I never told anyone.
Yeah.
I never told my brother, never told my my parents, and before I even got to Penn State University, I began to drink.
Mm-hmm.
What I would do is, and I'm sure other kids have done this, where I would raid my parents' liquor cabinet and put it all in and mix it all from all the different bottles into a mason jar, right?
Right.
And fill all the bottles with water so my parents couldn't tell there were less, right, watering down their booze. And I would drink these mason jars and get drunk on my own alone. So I didn't have to feel the shame and the pain.
Absolutely.
And
I'm going to mention this. If you're joining us now, I don't want to interrupt you. We're talking to Brian Cuban. And yes, Mark Cuban's brother. And an amazing story of trauma and strength. because, man, where you are, what you're doing, what you have done with your life, I personally think it's more than your brother did, you know, in a way. You, as I said before, you're making a difference, and I'm not sitting here like kissing your butt, you know. It's the truth. You know, the ones that have got into recovery, we have stopped, and that are giving back. That's the real
yeah,
deal.
You know what? I try not to compare. Mark makes a difference. You know, Jeff, my younger brother, Jeff, makes a difference. We just all have different paths, right?
Mm-hmm.
We just all do it in our own. We just do it in our different way. But I moved on to Penn State. And by the time I moved into my sophomore year at Penn State, I was a full-blown alcoholic. I was, drinking every night. It was all alone. I had no friends. I would go out for any one of your listeners who have been to main campus of Penn State.
Yeah.
There is an alley where all the bars are. And I would go to the liquor store, the state store, and I would buy one of those little tequila bottles, and I would go into the alley in State College, University Park, and I would chug the tequila so I could get drunk in the hope I would turn myself into something else to go in, up, you know, to go to the bar and be social, right?
Yeah.
And not be that person who was, you know, physically assaulted, not be that person who hated himself, to maybe see someone different if I saw my reflection. But it never worked out that way. It only made me more depressed, and which caused me to drink more. And I remember the closest I ever came to any epiphany on recovery. I walked into a hamburger joint. It was like 1 a.m. after being in a bar all night by myself drinking. And they had a rack of pamphlets out. And I don't know if they still do this. The 20 questions, the pamphlets, the 20 questions.
Yeah, yeah.
It was towards college students.
Yeah.
Do you pass out, miss class, you know, blah, blah, do you black out? And I'm checking off yes to all these questions. And, of course, you know, it's call us, right? And I believe it was the 12-step number. Call us, the local 12-step. And I read it. I'm checking off yes to all these things. I crumpled it up, and I tossed it in a basket. I'm a college student.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to face this stuff. And that was really as close as I ever came.
Let me ask you something, Brian. What's with Penn State? I got to tell you, my father, all my relatives went to Penn State. My father died at 94 years old, and he told us, our whole lives, the greatest place in the world was at Penn State. What the hell went on there?
I had a much different experience than your father.
Yeah, I guess you did.
It was not a good four years for me. I kept to myself.
Yeah.
Like I said, I was an alcoholic. I didn't have any friends. I didn't go to Penn State games. And you know what was funny? The worst part of my existence there was on Saturdays, right?
Uh-huh.
When you would just throng thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of students walking out to Beaver Stadium, having fun, you know, girls and guys holding hands and dates. And I wasn't part of that. And it made me feel alone.
That is sad beyond belief, man.
Yeah, and it made me feel very alone. So what would I do? I would drink.
Right. Right.
Because I wanted to be included in all that. So Penn State wasn't necessarily a happy time.
No, it wasn't for you.
Happy Valley.
But did you get...
It wasn't Happy Valley.
No, it wasn't Happy Valley for you. Now, you must have gotten good grades. Did you go to law school right after Penn State?
I did, and I got okay grades. I had an easy major. I was a criminal justice major.
Yeah.
I wanted to be a police officer. That would have worked out well.
Yeah, right. Well, it probably would have, actually.
Yeah, I don't know. I'd have been the first guy in the evidence room trading out the baby laxative for the blow.
Yeah, right. Oh, yeah. Hey, let me ask you a question. You were interviewed after the Penn State sex scandal with Joe Paterno and Jerry Sandusky.
I was, yeah.
Yeah, why did they come to you?
Just a name, just because my last name. I barely even remember it now.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, just my last name. And I was very vocal about it.
Yeah.
Jerry's where he belongs. There are a lot of truthers, you know, who say Jerry's innocent. I'm not one of them.
Right.
You know, it's the whole thing is just wild. I mean, Jerry is right where he belongs.
Yeah.
I hope he dies there.
Crazy stuff. Listen, we got to take our first break. so much more we have to ask you, and our audience is, I mean, there's so many people watching and listening to the show because we could see it on our screen. So, guys, don't go away. We'll be back with Brian Cuban in just a moment.
This is Clean and Sober Radio.
A cancer diagnosis can knock the wind out of you. The Sidney Kimmel Cancer Center at Abington Jefferson Health can help. Our brand new Asplund Cancer Pavilion brings you 86,000 square feet of cancer-fighting science for truly comprehensive care. Backed by the strength of an NCI-designated cancer center. Call 1-800-JEFF-NOW. The Sidney Kimmel Cancer Center at Abington Jefferson Health. The power to out-science cancer.
Hi, this is Dion, the Wanderer. Listen to Clean and Sober Radio. You might hear something that'll change your life. Yo!
888-728-9941. This is Clean and Sober Radio.
On that magic carpet ride last night. But when you wake up in the morning, the world still keeps you uptight. Well, there's nothing better you ain't tried to fill the emptiness inside. When you come back down, girl, still.
Hey, Brian, you remember that song?
I do.
Yeah. I love that song.
Well,
I'm showing my age. I don't think about your age. Let me tell you something. We want to mention a lot of people are watching us right now. You know, let's start with Kathy Wolf Collin from Coral Springs, Florida. Glad to be watching your show. Judge Christopher Maddox from Upper Darby, Pennsylvania, is watching the show. Brian, we have a lot of judges who watch this show. It's kind of different than when we were in front of them. You know what I mean?
You believe me. I know.
Yeah, I bet you do know.
I do know.
Yeah, I know you do. David Martinez.
You know what's funny?
What?
The judge who handled, when I got busted for DWI, judge who handled that is now the district attorney. You know? And we're good friends because I'm on the district attorney advisory task force here in Dallas County.
Beautiful. Isn't it? It's so ironic that we have that kind of stuff going on, isn't it? You know,
it is.
You know, I had a party for my 40th anniversary for recovery 2 years ago, and I had a lot of judges come to my house for the party. And I said to them, you know, judges, 43 years ago, I'd be standing in front of you shackled, and now you're in my house, man. It's like,
crazy how this stuff hangs around. I just had
to feel that, Feel on the steel is part of the resume.
What were you going to say, Mark?
Well, I had to get like the certification, you know, for counseling that I had to go. And I just got I got notified that I have a DUI from 1997. Well, I knew I did, but I had to write like this whole thing about what happened, where it was. And I'm like, these skeletons, you just want them to stay in your closet. You know what I mean?
You want to hear a funny story? A few years back, I do a lot of public speaking on addiction and mental health. So I was doing a gig in Canada. So my buddy picks me up in Detroit, and we have to go over the border. We're at the port of entry, the border crossing. I hand him my passport, and the border agent, you know, he's typing something, and he goes, "You out of the car." I'm like, "No, him? My God, no, you." Holy hell. So he takes me in this back room and starts asking me all these questions. And then he gets to the one, and I remember he did it like a game show host. "Have you ever been arrested?"
Yeah, right.
And he was waiting for me to lie, right? Yeah. So I can, you know, so they can deny the entry. And, you know, a conviction for a DWI, fortunately I beat it. But a conviction for a DWI, you know, that you're not allowed over the border.
I didn't know that.
I didn't make it over because of that, by the way.
Really?
We do the same thing. You're coming in from Canada, you have a DWI conviction. Yeah, you're not getting across. So, I'm panicking. When was it? Because it was like 30 years ago. And I'm panicking. And I'm like, yeah, it was like 1990, and he goes, "Okay, you're okay," and he lets me through.
Jeez,
wow!
He was waiting for me to lie so he could send me back.
I thought you were going to say, he was going to say to you, tell me you're related to Mark Cuban and wait for...
Yeah, this is Canada. They didn't care.
You're lucky because I was going over Glacier National Park right on the border there, and I was going, I had like three girls and a friend of mine, and we're going to go over to Canada, and they stop us and they tell us to go up into this room, you know, where we have to give our IDs. And he's like, listen, he can't go. And I'm like, what do you mean you can't go? And he's like, you have a, you know, DUI on your record and it's a felony in Canada.
He's pointing at you at this point.
Yeah, he's pointing at me.
It's a felony.
It's a felony. And he's saying you can't go across the border unless it's amount of years and you have to pay like $300 or something. And I'll tell you what, I was so depressed. Like, they drove me not even all the way back to where I was staying, and I hitchhiked from there, and they went over and had a blast in Canada. And it was awful. That's awful, Brian. Yeah.
That's terrible. Brian, so let's...
I know a few people that's happened to.
Like you, yeah. So let's talk about some physical issues that you have had in the past or you're still having. You had a condition, besides addiction, body dysmorphia. Can you
body dysmorphic disorder? Yeah.
Can you tell our audience what that means?
Sure. What that is, we hear the term thrown around a lot, right? You know, body dysmorphia and stuff.
Yeah.
But it's an actual diagnosis that affects about 2% of the population, men and women equally. And it's basically when you look at your reflection in the mirror and you see a distorted reflection. Mm-hmm. And it's more of an obsessive compulsive feeling that you're not seeing what's really there. And it has a very high correlation to eating disorders. I'm in recovery from bulimia.
Right.
It has a high correlation to suicide. I've come near suicide. Mm-hmm. It has a very, I'm hitting all the correlations. It has a high correlation to addiction. So for me, alcohol and cocaine. It has a high correlation to steroid use. And I've been addicted to anabolic steroids. So I've gone through everything. And it's been, that's probably been my toughest struggle with body image. And realize, you know what I came to learn about myself?
What?
The drinking and the cocaine was an effort to see someone different, right?
Yeah.
Because when I did a lot of cocaine, all of a sudden I loved myself.
Right.
Sure. And I remember going back to I did my first line of cocaine in 1987 in a bar in Dallas, Texas. And up until that time, I was 26 years old, I had hated myself my entire life, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. All I saw was a fat pig in the mirror. And I did this cocaine. My buddy introduced me to his dealer. He gave me a free sample line. I get out of the bathroom and I do this cocaine. And then for the first time in my life, the very first time, I loved myself. I loved the guy in the mirror. I wasn't horrified by the guy in the mirror. Mm-hmm. The guy in the mirror was good looking. The guy in the mirror was popular, right? The guy in the mirror was loved by every girl I was going to talk to upstairs. And so I go upstairs and I'm Mr. Cubes, right? Dancing. Yeah. But then what happened? The line wears off.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, Brian hates wine again. Well, where's that dealer? I find the dealer. I gave him my last, I think it was $90 for a gram back then.
Yeah.
I gave it to him and Brian all of a sudden went back downstairs and Brian loved Brian again. And that is really kind of another snapshot when cocaine began to take over my life.
Was this a result of, or part of it when those kids accosted you? Was this a result of being tortured by your peers?
I think that played a factor. Again, cause is not correlation, right?
Yeah.
I think there are a lot of factors that came into play, but they all went into the soup and came out, Brian, that Brian, right? And, that traumatic incident certainly was a factor, and it was really me searching in all, very destructive ways for ways to love myself.
Well, listen, if you're listening or watching us, our number here, this is a wonderful opportunity to speak with Brian Cuban. Our number is 1-888-728-9941. That's 1-888-728-9941. 800-516-9941. Brian, how did your family deal with your stuff?
Well, they didn't know anything about it until I decided to end my life by suicide in 2005. And because I really only hung around with the people I did blow with, right? And I kept to a very insular party circle. And I had already, you know, and I had lost my career as a lawyer.
Yeah.
And here's where privilege comes in. I have enjoyed enormous privilege in my life, and I acknowledge that. And I, you know, that most people don't have a billionaire brother who didn't want to see him living under a bridge, right?
Yeah, sure.
So my brother was really helping me out at a time when I had no way to support myself because I was no longer a functioning lawyer. And that is privilege, and I acknowledge that.
Did you lose your license?
But, no, believe it or not, I did not lose my license, but it wasn't for a lack of trying.
Yeah, well, you know, that's such
I was not an ethical lawyer. I was not an ethical lawyer. I was better called, I was Saul Goodman without the drug cartels.
If, Brian, where, if Mark Cuban was not your brother, what do you think would have happened to you?
I don't know. I really don't know. I mean, I might be dead. I might be alive. I might be in the same spot. How do you know, right?
No, you don't.
How can you go back and how can you know?
Right.
But what I can tell you is that my people say, well, he enabled me. Well, you know, by making sure that I had a way to pay my rent and stuff. Well, yeah, but I'm alive.
Yeah, yeah, right? Absolutely. Yeah, that,
I'm
that
weird,
whole,
I'm alive.
You know, that whole thing about throwing the person out of the house, I don't buy it. I just, it's so easy for, you know, somebody to say it, you know?
What is the great, you know, every family fights, you know, when you have a loved one struggling. You've
yes.
seen this, I've seen it. That gray area, that really amorphous gray area between love, enablement, and recovery.
Yeah, yeah.
Nobody wants to feel the guilt of throwing someone out and then they die, right?
That's right.
So every situation is different. So, but I also know families that have been bankrupted by their child.
Absolutely.
Right? Hundreds of thousands of dollars spent on treatment and this and that. I know one, a dear friend of mine, their son bankrupted them. And then they finally said, you can't stay here until you find recovery. I got him into a transitional living facility in Dallas, and he died by overdose.
Yeah, 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 you don't.
He died by overdose. You just don't know.
Yeah,
you just don't know.
Nobody knows. Nobody knows.
Yeah.
Right. I think we have we have another caller coming in. But before we take that, so how did you get? I get the law enforcement with the books that you have written. Is this a wannabe cop kind of thing?
No, you know what? How I got to law school is I was sitting in a room one day, and two guys in my major. We're talking about going into law school and taking the LSATs. And I started listening to them. I had never thought one iota about being a lawyer.
Yeah.
Ever. Didn't know any lawyers. No one in my family's a lawyer. But you know what I heard?
What?
That law school was 3 years. So I could go to law school.
Oh, and still continue,
engage in the behaviors that I was engaging in that in my mind were survival behaviors.
Yeah.
I was bulimic. I was an alcoholic. Yes, guys do get eating disorders for your listeners. And I was engaging in these behaviors that were my security blanket because I was really just surviving at the tip of my nose and I didn't know any other way. And I figured, well, if I go to law school, that's 3 more years where I can survive at the tip of my nose. And it made perfect sense to me. It made perfect sense to me.
It makes perfect sense. It makes, you know how twisted we are. We're shaking our heads going, it still makes perfect sense.
Yeah. I mean, back in 2007, calling my drug dealer and getting, eight balls two separate nights, then flushing it down the toilet each night made perfect sense.
Absolutely.
Right?
Brian, we have a caller on the line. Frank, welcome to Clean and Sober Radio.
Hey, Frank.
Hey, guys. To begin the program, you mentioned about anniversaries. You mentioned, I was thinking every day is an anniversary, but then you said that, so I'm happy because it took me forever and a couple more days to get some time.
Yeah.
And it's so great now because I don't think about it all day long. I'm not worried about it. I'm not worried about anything. I got a ton of problems, But as they say, I'm dealing with life on life terms. I feel so good and everything, being sober. Yeah. I throw a recommendation for anyone listening, trying to get sober. Are you there, guys?
Yeah, we're here.
We're listening.
Listen, we're here, and Brian Cuban is listening to you, too.
I got a comment for Brian, too.
Yeah.
I'm saving up for the end. A great comment for Brian.
Okay.
I did meetings for years. I read the books. I went to rehabs. Nothing was working for me.
Yeah.
So just don't drink today. I kept saying that. Don't drink today. It never happened. Over the last couple months, I was it. One day, March of 2020, I went on a binge after a couple of months. I said to myself, I know I'm going to drink again, but let me just get a couple of days sober to recover a little bit. I kept telling myself, I know I'm going to drink again. I've been fighting this for too long. I'm a drunk. I know I'm going to do it again. I kept telling myself, not today. That's how I got sober, by telling myself, I know I'm going to do it. I know I'm going to drink. I've done it before in the past. I know I'm going to do it. And I got sober by doing that.
No matter how you do it.
That's great. Yeah.
And Brian.
No, it's funny. I was watching a show called, have you ever seen The Wire, you guys, Frank?
No, never did.
Well, there's a show called The Wire, and there's this guy named Bubs, and he's talking to a guy who had become a sponsor. And I remember the guy vividly said to him, getting clean is the easy part. Then comes life.
That's for sure.
I heard that, too. Hey, Brian, you ready for this question?
Sure.
I'm also a Cuban. Do you know me?
My last name
is Cuban. I'm first generation Cuba from Havana, Cuba.
Okay, we're different kinds of Cuban. You are a Cuban. Now I'm actually Russian.
Yeah, I know. I've seen your brother in Shark Tank a couple times.
Our last name is a shortened version, Russian version of a Jewish last name.
What was your last name, Brian?
I want to say it was Chabinovich.
Okay.
Chabinovich.
Where are you from? Kiev?
On one side, on my mom's side, Lithuania, and then also a little town in Ukraine called Novoselita, and then on my father's side, Kiev, actually, and the Odessa area.
But wait, guys, listen, Brian and Frank, I also have a connection with Cuban. I smoke Cuban cigars. Does that make us related or what?
Hey, guys, get this. Yeah. You ready?
Yeah.
My dad was a fireman back in way back when, the 80s, 90s, or 60s, 60s, 70s, 80s. We went to Cuba to see my grandma. A lot of his fireman friends were smokers. We brought back boxes of Cuban cigars. At the airport in Miami, you claim how many you can bring back.
Yeah.
I think one per person, me and my dad. But he had, like 20 different things of cigars. I said, Dad, I only put one, because Frankie, they won't check. I said, Dad, you got to be honest. So we lost about 20 cases of cigars. They put them to the side. They had a trash can there at the airport.
Yeah.
He said, rip them up. No, we throw them. And now you're going to keep on. Rip them up. And they refused to. My dad made a big scene, and then they ripped them up in the trash can.
Oh, man.
But I was being Mr. Honest, and a lot of my dad's firemen friends got two cigars instead of two boxes.
Hey, Frank, thanks for the call.
Thanks,
really
Frank.
Enjoyed it, buddy. Take care.
Thanks, Frank.
Good guy. Again, okay, just so everybody knows, we're talking to Brian Cuban. I want to read this list again when I started off, because Brian Cuban is an authority on male eating disorders, drug addiction, drug rehabilitation, and alcoholism. But, and this is the nice part, he's a lawyer and an activist in the areas of the First Amendment issues and hate speech. That's pretty.
You know what, Gary, I always cringe a little when someone says I'm an authority. You know what I'm authority on? My story.
Yeah, I know you're an authority on your resume. I get it.
That's right.
And I actually, as I was reading, I was like, he's probably sick of hearing this crap, you know. But you know what? It shows that we can recover and do really good things. And I'll tell you the good thing we have to do right now. We have to take another break, okay?
Take that station break.
Don't go away. We'll be right back.
This is Clean and Sober Radio.
A cancer diagnosis can knock the wind out of you. The Sidney Kimmel Cancer Center at Abington Jefferson Health can help. Our brand new Asplund Cancer Pavilion brings you 86,000 square feet of cancer-fighting science for truly comprehensive care. Backed by the strength of an NCI-designated cancer center. Call 1-800-JEFF-NOW. The Sidney Kimmel Cancer Center at Abington Jefferson Health. The power to outscience cancer.
Hey, everybody, this is former Philadelphia Flyer Chris Terrien, and you're listening to Clean and Sober Radio.
888-728-9941. This is Clean and Sober Radio.
And we are back with Brian Cuban, who, by the way, is not Cuban. Okay, everybody? Brian, thanks for sticking with us, man.
How many times I have to tell people that?
What's this?
You wouldn't believe how many times I have to tell people that I'm not Cuban.
Oh, of course. Do they ever ask you, Fidel Castro?
Yeah.
So, Brian, we also get emails during the week. And here's one. Philip G. from Madison, Wisconsin. It appears to – oh, this is weird. It appears to be ridiculous about the number of overdoses you guys spew every week. Come on. 120,000 plus each year? You need to fact check your information.
Oh, geez.
You know what I'd like to say to him if we weren't on the air?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, and it's...
I mean, my response would be, what's your point? My response would be, okay, what's your point? Whatever the actual number is.
Yeah.
You know, one is one too many, right?
Yeah, one's one too many. You know, look,
so what's the point of the email?
And here, then we get this one from Bridget L. from Miami. Love the show 2 weeks ago with former Philadelphia Philly Randy Lurch. That's a nice email.
Yes. And right? He was awesome.
Yeah, he was awesome. Not as good as Brian, though. I'm going to tell you right now. Okay.
I remember Randy from a silly day.
Yeah, do you? Yeah, yeah. You know what happened to him? Brian, the Phillies doctor was supplying all the Phillies with amphetamines, and Randy, for some reason, dimed the doctor out, and then they traded him.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was crazy.
Well,
Randy had some good years.
Yeah, yeah, he certainly did. I just got to announce Steven Sussman from Florida, West Palm Beach is watching. Robin Davis, Mimi Dorshu. Everyone loved One Does Their Best. Everyone loved, well, I don't know. I don't know what this says. Anyway, okay, I have no idea. So wait a minute, Brian. So tell me, It seems like you grew up in a loving family, and then like you, I became different than the rest of my family, with all the addiction, and I didn't have the money you had, but from the music business, I had plenty of money, which enabled me to survive in a sick way.
I don't have money. That's my brother.
Well, I know, but you had access to it. I know that. But yeah, listen, Brian, I stole what I wanted. I can tell you that.
Yeah, I hear you.
You know, let's see what else.
I was interested, Brian, in how when you made that decision to you got sober, right? And then you're here. It is, you have this underlying issue with body dysmorphia. How long did it take you to kind of get your eye on that and get treatment? You know, we always talk about this kind of co-occurring.
Let's give some context. It was Easter weekend 2007, and I had a two-day drug and alcohol induced blackout, and my girlfriend, now my wife, she stood by me, had just moved in with me. And she went away for the weekend, and I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to go out, have a good time. I'll be showered, and she'll never know, right? I'd lie.
Yeah.
She didn't know anything about my drug issues. And so she goes away, and the next thing I know, it's 2 days later. I'm in bed. She's staring down at me.
Ooh.
And I'm trying to figure out what time it is, you know, what day it is. And there's cocaine lined out on the dresser, and there's, you know, wine bottles and beer bottles. I don't know who's been in my house. And, you know, she's probably wondering if she walked in the right house. I'm trying to figure out how to explain this Law and Order episode orgy of evidence that I wasn't the person I represented myself to be.
Right.
You know,
yes.
This upstanding sober lawyer.
Yep.
So
yep.
All I could think of was kind of a metaphorical running home to mama. I told her, I named a psychiatric facility where I'd been in 2005 after coming close to killing myself.
Mm-hmm.
And she's, you've been to a psychiatric facility? I'm like, yeah, we'll talk about that.
Oh, man, Brian.
I know. I just need a ride down there so to buy time to think of a lie, right?
Yeah, sure.
To explain what there is no other explanation for is that I'm, you know, addicted to drugs and alcohol. So we get down there, and I'm standing in the parking lot now for the second time in my life in this psychiatric hospital facility. She's crying. I'm thinking she'd leave me. You know, I'd leave me.
Yeah.
She moved out, but she didn't. She stood by me while I rebuilt the broken trust and found recovery. And we've been together almost 19 years now.
Yeah, it's a beautiful story. And she's beautiful. So I've seen pictures.
Thank you. Not all relationships will survive that, but ours was able to. But because I did the work for me, right? Not for her, not for my dogs, not for my deceased parents, not for any of that. It had to be for me because life happens, right?
Yeah.
Then comes life, as I said. Just to finish up, so the next day after all of that, I walk into 12-step for the very first time. And I'm sitting in the chair, and I'm not thinking about alcoholic. You know what I was thinking sitting in that chair? And this is where it comes into body dysmorphia.
What?
I'm thinking if sitting in this chair every day will allow me for the first time in my life to wake up, walk to my bathroom mirror, birthday suit naked, stare at myself in the mirror, and love myself without the aid of alcohol or drugs, I will sit in this chair.
That's the best.
That is what I wanted more than anything in the world, was to love myself for the first time in my life. And now I'm in my 40s. And the process of that has been a slow process, even in sobriety. I'm still in therapy because body dysmorphia is a tough bear.
Yeah.
And people ask me what my biggest challenge is today. It is my relationship with my body.
Interesting.
And when I look in the mirror. But what's different now is I do it sober, right? I have a toolbox where having a feeling, seeing something, you know, understanding the difference between normative discontent, which means that every, you know, we all look in the mirror one time or another and say that sucks, right? I'm feeling this, I'm feeling that, I'm losing my hair, whatever, my pants don't fit. That's normative discontent versus allowing that feeling to dictate how we, you know, the behaviors we engaged in, drugs, alcohol, you know, whatever that is. And so I'm still in therapy for that.
Well, that's fabulous. I mean, to get to a healthy point of your relationship with your body. And I'm sure that's one thing I don't have, and I'm sure it's incredibly difficult.
But you know what? What's healthy? What does that even mean, healthy point? You know, who does have a real, you know, have a perfect, you know, I'll go on a limb and say no one has a perfect relationship with their body, right?
You know, well, Mark does here. Mark does here. Let me tell you, all right? You never
know. Definitely not. Depends on the day. And I put on
there you go.
A few pounds lately.
That's it.
Yeah.
That is what is known as normative discontent.
Right? Yeah, gotcha.
That is perfectly normal.
Brian, did you ever look in the mirror and think, oh, my God, I'm starting to look like my father? You know?
I am starting to look like my father. I limp like my father now.
Hey, by the way, how are your cats?
My cats are good. My one cat is right here next to me sleeping, and the other cat is probably hiding.
Yeah.
You know, my cats, keep me balanced, as my wife does.
I have two cats also.
Yeah. Butter's right here next to me snoozing.
Well, and what's the other one's name? Butter and what?
Mimi.
Butter and Mimi. Yeah, I've seen the cats plenty. And they do lay on you all the time, man.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
So sobriety, you know, sobriety isn't without its challenges, right?
Right, yes.
Because even, you know how it is, whether you're 40 years or, you know, 18 years, life is still life.
Yep.
And, you know, it gets tough. You know, sometimes it's easier than others. And facing it sober is a daily routine.
Well, Brian, again, thank you for coming on the show. You were an inspiration.
Can I mention my new book? Because it's set in Philadelphia.
Oh, yeah. Come on. Hit it.
Yeah. So I have a new crime thriller coming out, the sequel to The Ambulance Chaser. It is set in Kensington, Philadelphia.
All right. When's it coming out? Because we're going to.
It is coming out December 7th.
All right.
And it is pre-order right now. You can go online and pre-order it and maybe save some money. But it's about a lawyer who finds his girlfriend dead of a fentanyl overdose, mm-hmm. and he and her toxicologist roommate are taken from Pittsburgh to ground zero of the fentanyl epidemic, Kensington, Philadelphia, to prove she was murdered.
Okay, we're going to announce that. When that book comes out, we're going to announce it heavily for you, okay?
Well, thank you. And people who read it, you'll see, you know, Kensington Avenue, you'll see all of these landmarks, and you'll hear a lot of terminology that people involved in the fentanyl scene who understand the fentanyl scene will understand.
Okay, so we're going to talk the first or second week of December. I'll put it to call you. You'll give me the info, and we'll really announce the hell out of this book, okay?
Sounds good.
All right, Brian, thanks so much.
Brian.
We really appreciate it. Be well. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, guys. One day at a time.
You got it.
See you, Brian.
Remember, if you or a loved one is struggling with addiction, help is available. Please call 1-800-662-HELP. For Clean and Sober Radio, I'm Gary Hendler.
I'm Mark Sigmund.
Thank you all for giving the support you give us every week. Take care, everybody.
I'd like to say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves. I hope we pass the audition.